Well, good evening. Thank you so much for coming back. Wow. So it's great to see you. We've had a great couple of weeks in Australia, and the weather's been wonderful. And again, I would like to thank Gospel Conversations and CPX both for their role in making it possible for me to be here and to talk with you. So we're going to shift. I'm getting a little echo through here. Yeah. We're going to shift gears from Genesis 2 weeks ago to Deuteronomy, just a few pages over, relatively speaking, in the Bible, but a world of difference. And so we're going to be talking about what we find in Deuteronomy. Now, lots of people today reading the Bible don't find a whole lot in the book of Deuteronomy. In fact, if they try to work at reading through the Bible in a year, if they manage to slug it through Leviticus and Numbers, they finally get to Deuteronomy and despair strikes. And they say, please, give me Matthew, give me the New Testament, help me to get something that I can manage. It's interesting because Deuteronomy is a remarkably revolutionary book. Now, it was revolutionary in the ancient world, but lots of the things that it was revolutionary about are things that are so common to us that we don't see it as revolutionary. But even more so, some of the ways in which it should be revolutionary to us today is kind of beyond our grasp, and we haven't seen it. So tonight and tomorrow, we're going to talk about the revolutionary nature of the book of Deuteronomy. And we're going to start with the ancient world context, and by the end of tomorrow, we will have discussed also the modern world and why Deuteronomy should be revolutionary today. So that kind of plots out kind of where we're going and how we're working through it. So what exactly made Deuteronomy revolutionary in the ancient world? By the way, as I begin, you'll notice I do not have the PowerPoint going. We will get the PowerPoint later on this evening, and we'll have it some tomorrow as well. The Genesis PowerPoints were done professionally. These were not. Sometimes my artistic son, who designs lots of my PowerPoint things, have called my PowerPoints student abuse. But at any rate, we'll give it a try. So we'll get to the PowerPoint a little bit later on, but I want to do the introduction for us, so I'll just talk for a little bit. What was so revolutionary about Deuteronomy in the ancient world? Well, the way they thought about God, the way they thought about themselves, the way they thought about the world, the way they thought about the relationship with God, just to name a few. Deuteronomy presents something that is truly unique in the ancient world. And it was so unique that the Israelites themselves had trouble grasping the full program and owning it as their own. They eventually got it. It took 1,000 years. 1,000 years. Before they really got the grasp of what it was that was being presented to them in the book of Deuteronomy. So let me paint the picture for you in the ancient world. And then we'll talk about Deuteronomy and how that sought to revolutionize that ancient world. In the ancient world, people believed that gods had made the world for themselves. They never anticipated people. People were not on the plan. The gods were autonomous and existed for themselves. But these were gods who had needs. Gods who needed to eat. They needed a place to live. They needed clothing. Basically, as the people in the ancient world understood the gods, these gods were sort of like people, except more powerful. After all, in the ancient world, they had created the gods in their own image. And so they assumed that the gods had needs. They thought of the gods pretty much the way they thought of their kings, except more. Okay? And so here were the gods living in their own world for themselves, made by them, for them, and that's always anticipated. But this lingering need that the gods had led them to some creative thinking. You know, they thought, things could be a lot better if we had somebody to do this work for us. Now, they tried it a little bit with the younger gods providing for the older gods. That didn't work so well. We have several of the myths in the ancient world that talk about how the younger gods revolted against this system, that they should be worked so hard to provide the needs for these lazy elder gods. And so, from all of that revolt and rebellion comes the idea, we can create slave labor. And so they did. And they created human beings. They made them enough like gods so that they could do the work they needed to do, but they also withheld certain things from them. Immortality, wisdom, and power. You can have everything else. But no immortality, limited wisdom, limited power. And so people were created as an afterthought. No dignity. The only dignity they could derive from their meager lives was that the gods needed them. And so they grew their food, and the food was given as offerings to the gods so the gods could have something to eat. And they built their beautiful temples so the gods would have a place to live. And they made beautiful clothing for these marvelous images. And so the gods were given all the best of everything. And so their needs were met. Now, of course, if the gods wanted this system to work, they also had to make sure that people thrived. Because after all, if people were not able to grow food, they couldn't give any food to the gods. If people were struggling under the weight of bad rulers or invaded by enemies, then their crops were burned or their food was taken or they couldn't grow it in the first place and things went very badly and they couldn't provide for the gods. See, the gods had to do everything for humans that would allow humans to do what they needed to do for the gods. Now, this is what I call the great symbiosis. And I think I might have mentioned it, referred to it, when we talked about Genesis, just in passing. This is the great symbiosis. It's a codependent relationship between the gods and people. Gods provide for people and protect people. The people provide for the gods and, in a sense, protect their space. And so this relationship develops. Now, how did people come to think that the gods had needs? After all, okay, remember, this whole idea of the gods was not revealed to them. None of the gods said, okay, let me tell you how all this worked. You know, how it all started, you know. No, nothing like that. There is no revelation in the ancient world. The gods are not forthcoming. The gods don't even communicate the nature of their needs or what they expected so that their needs would be provided. People had to guess. It's kind of a lousy system, really. I mean, imagine if you had an employer who told you, well, we're not going to tell you really what your job is, and you're not going to get a job description, and you'll never know what you're being evaluated on, but if you don't do it, we're going to fire you. That wouldn't be good. And yet that's how it was. Some of you are saying, yeah, I have a boss like that. No, okay. But that's how it was in the ancient world. So all they could do was deduce or infer what the gods wanted. They could infer it because they figured it was what kings want, but more. They could deduce because sometimes things started really going badly for them. Enemies invaded them, towns got burned, crops didn't grow, no rain, sickness in the family, something goes wrong. And they say, well, we must not be doing what the gods expected of us, whatever that was in the first place. We just know that their needs should be met, and we're trying our best to do that, but we really don't know what that looks like. One of my students once equated this to having a crying six-month-old. You know they need something, and they're making life miserable for you, but you don't know what it is. There are a couple basic solutions. Pat it, change it, feed it. Okay? That's kind of how it worked with the gods. Try to make the god happy. We don't know quite how to do that, but that's what we have to do. We have to try to make the god happy. The god hasn't said what will make them happy. They have these needs, and we try to provide them, but we really don't know how to do that except by experimentation, and it doesn't always work very well. And so the people would experience misery in their lives, and they would say, some god's angry. They don't know why. They don't know which one. And they don't know what to do about it. Religion of despair. Because gods only care about their needs, and they are not forthcoming about what those are. That is the religious system of the ancient world. That is the world in which Israel existed. Selfish gods, filled with themselves, not caring about humanity, only wanting their needs met, and lashing out at anything. But that is what a world looks like when there are unpredictable gods and no revelation. That's the only possible result. And so people had this idea that their religious obligation was simply to meet the needs of the gods. Now, that meant that they weren't worried about, I was going to say they weren't worried about sin. And they weren't, if you think of sin the way we do in our Christian definitions. They were certainly worried about offense. Because if you offend the gods by not doing what they're expecting of you, problems. So they were worried about their offenses. But they didn't have a moral sense of guilt about those kinds of offenses. They only feared the consequences. By the way, as I'm describing the ancient world, you may find occasional flickers of saying, wait a minute, some people still think that way today. In fact, some Christians still think like that today. So don't miss those moments as you pick them up. So they did not think that there is any hope of relationship with the gods. The only relationship there was to be had with the gods was a relationship of mutual need, and that is a dysfunctional relationship. They did not think that the gods would love them. At least not beyond how you would love somebody who gives you everything that you want. That's kind of shallow. They did not believe that the gods cared for them or that they could be in any kind of relationship with the gods. Again, except this codependent, dysfunctional one. They did not believe that the gods wanted them as people to imitate the gods. What in the world was there to imitate? They were just being selfish and exercising their power at whim. They wouldn't want to be like God, and those gods wouldn't say, you should be like us. Matter of fact, they often did things to say, to cut off that process of being like them. So religion in the ancient world was not based on really the nature, the character of God. It was not based on some kind of ethical or moral foundation. It was not based on revelation from the God or relationship with the God. Religion was the carrying out of duty. The duty of rituals and temples just to try to keep the gods off their back. Desperate times and desperate people. That's the world that Deuteronomy comes into. And the contrast is stunning. Now, we sometimes like to think, I have to back up a little bit here, because we sometimes like to think that somehow this idea of God that we have today was something that has existed throughout history from the time of Adam all the way through Noah, through Abraham, Moses, that this has kind of always existed, sometimes maybe in a select minority. No, it hasn't. I can't talk about what things looked like from Adam to Noah, although we're told about things in the world that went wrong, obviously, very wrong. We're not told about this movement from Noah to Abraham, but we do know one thing, that Abraham did not come from some pristine religious background that had a full and understanding view of Yahweh, the God who becomes the God of Israel. Abraham is not preserving a tradition of right religion that's been handed down from those early days. We know this from the Bible. Abraham comes from an idolatrous background, from standard Mesopotamian stock, and not following some tradition of proper belief and understanding of God. When you get to the time of Abraham, proper knowledge of God is gone. It is lost from the world. There is no one with a proper knowledge of God. And so God comes to Abraham. Interestingly enough, he doesn't start with a doctrinal statement. He doesn't start with a list of his attributes. He doesn't start with a creed or form a council. He starts with, have I got something for you? But you got to give up something to get it. What an interesting way to start. But it makes total sense in the ancient religious system of the Great Symbiosis. Because remember, in the Great Symbiosis, there is this mutual dependency. And so God leads with something that's going to get developed as time goes on, but he leads with, you know, I need you to leave your land, but I'm going to give you a land. And I need you to leave your family, but I'm going to give you a family. I need you to leave your inheritance and all you have to gain in your social structure. I'm going to make you a blessing. So let's start there. Let's start, God says, in your Mesopotamian world, and we'll work from there. And step by step, through Abraham and Isaac and Jacob And through the centuries in Egypt, we finally arrive at Moses and Deuteronomy. Now, is that a great success story? No, if you read the Bible, you'll find it's really not. By the time the people who've come out of Egypt, they haven't gotten a clue from all of that. They worshipped idols in Egypt. They worshipped idols in the wilderness. The biblical text tells us this. So they were far from understanding how this faith basis presented to Abraham was going to do anything for them. But Deuteronomy rocks their world. So in Deuteronomy, we find the foundation of the biblical faith that was in such contrast to what the rest of the world knew. And as I said, it was so mind-boggling, so revolutionary, that it took the Israelites 1,000 years to get it down pat. Because it's easy to think of the gods having needs. It's easy for us to think that God needs our worship, that God needs our money, that God needs our love, that God needs our relationship, that God needs what we have to offer. It's easy to think God has needs. It's hard to free the system of all of that. So Deuteronomy comes along into this world to make a difference in how people thought about God. And instead of this idea of the great symbiosis, this codependent, dysfunctional, mutual need relationship, instead of that, Deuteronomy puts in its place what I call the covenant symbiosis. Not the great symbiosis of the gods having needs, a covenant symbiosis, which is going to sound a little bit familiar, but strikingly different. In the covenant symbiosis, as in the great symbiosis, God says to the Israelites, I'm going to provide for you. I'm going to protect you. I'm going to do for you. I'm willing to work on your behalf. That's what the gods in the ancient Near East were willing to do, but for a very different reason. Because in Israel, God said, but what you do for me has nothing to do with needs. I don't have any. Frankly, I don't need you. God longed for eternity past without you, and I don't need you. But don't get disheartened because of that, because what you should know is, I love you. Mind-boggling. See, we don't catch it because we think of a God who loves us. We've been through Jesus. We can think this way, and it doesn't seem so striking to us. But this idea that a God should love his people, and several times the prophets will say, has anything like this in the world ever happened before? That a God should love his people like this. How incredible it is. So the covenant symbiosis says, instead of thinking in terms of you meeting my needs, this is what I want. I want to be in relationship with you. I want to dwell in your midst, not just so I'm there for you to feed. My temple is not going to be a place where you take care of my needs. My temple is going to be a place where we relate together. And if I'm going to live in your midst and we're going to be in relationship, that means you have to be certain kinds of people. Because it's not just about offering rituals to meet my needs. Remember, I don't have any. It's about being the kind of person having the character that I have. You are to be like me. And, you know, I'm going to give you something that will help you know what that looks like. Now, again, we miss all this, but imagine an Israelite audience just, you're going to what? Yeah, I'm going to reveal myself. I'm going to tell you what I expect of you. I'm going to tell you how it works so that you can actually know what you're doing as you relate with me. Revelation is revolutionary. Relationship is revolutionary. Acting as people with character, morality, integrity, because of who God is revolutionary. And so I hope you can begin to understand some of this world-changing thinking that was going on as Deuteronomy unfolds. The objective of the law that God gave the Israelites was not to impose some legalistic system on them. It was not to impose some burdensome obligation that people would walk around and say, why do we have to do all this stupid stuff? The law was God saying to his people, I expect you to be holy as I am holy. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about what that will look like for you. And the people did not groan, all this stuff that we have to do. This is so toilsome. Have you read the Old Testament? Have you read Psalms? The joy of the law, the beauty of God's law. That's not how we're used to thinking about it in Christian circles. But remember, for them, the law was revelation. And revelation is an act of grace. And so, you'll like this one. The law is grace. We'll deal with Paul later. Now, that's just a little bit of hint of some of what we're going to develop tomorrow. I want to spend the rest of my time tonight focusing specifically on what we call the Decalogue, what you may know better as the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments is at the core of the book of Deuteronomy, and I'll explain that more tomorrow, exactly how that works. The Ten Commandments is at the core of Deuteronomy, and of course, in some ways, it's at the core of biblical teaching and what we believe the Bible is all about, the Ten Commandments. I mean, once we get beyond Christ and salvation and he died for us and those kinds of things, we often talk about the Bible and the Ten Commandments. Now, as I often talk about the importance of understanding the ancient world for interpreting the Bible, I find that some people still are a little skeptical about that. And they sort of say, well, you know, we've got all we need, and we understand the Bible pretty well, and we can get by fine without the ancient world. We really don't need to get into all of that. I mean, after all, what difference does it make? Where does it really change how we think? Well, I'm going to show you how in the Ten Commandments, the ones we can get to tonight, that it changes entirely our understanding of these commandments. In fact, we have pretty badly botched a number of the Ten Commandments because we think of them in modern terms rather than understanding what they were in the ancient world. And we're not going to capture this revolutionary aspect of the Book of Deuteronomy, the Ten Commandments in the ancient world, nor are we going to understand how they are to be revolutionary for us today if we're not catching the drift of what's behind them. So, we probably won't get past like Commandment 4, but we'll try to do a few of them tonight. And if we can get the PowerPoint going, we'll talk about some of the issues in the Ten Commandments that may be a little different today than how we've thought. And again, this picks up the revolutionary aspect both in the ancient world and in our modern world. So, commandment number one, you shall have no other gods before me. What's that commandment all about? Again, in the ancient world, remember, it comes to a polytheistic culture. They could not imagine a world with just one God. Why? Several reasons. One, in the ancient world, they thought of everything in sort of corporate terms. That is, we very easily today think of ourselves in terms of individuals. I'm from America. Individualism is really a big, big thing. And it's probably somewhat the same here. We think, I'm responsible for me. I have my hopes and dreams and my decisions and choices and all of that. I'm an individual. Boy, scrap that in the ancient world. That's not how they thought at all. They were a corporate thinking society. And they thought of themselves in terms of their obligation to their community and to their family clan and to the group that they were in. And they had criteria for evaluating themselves based on those kinds of issues. Marriage took place that way. Everything took place that way. Inheritance took place that way. Everything in a corporate way of thinking. You don't have individuals. That's a little overstatement, but that's not their inclination. So, if they, as people, lived and acted and decided in community, and they make the gods in their own images, then the gods need a community. Who would ever think to have just one god? The gods need a community. And so, that's how they thought about the gods. Now, there's another reason. The other reason was that since the gods were connected to the world of nature, and there were lots of different aspects to the world of nature, and the gods were connected with national entities, and there are lots of different national entities, you can understand then that there are lots of different gods for lots of the different parts of nature and lots of the different nations around. Lots of gods. So, this is, and the Israelites thought the same. Remember, that's the hardest thing that the Israelites have trouble with have getting past, that there's only one God. They just couldn't fathom it. Nobody in the ancient world thought that way. Commandment one, you shall have no other gods before me. Okay, what does it say and what does it not say? Notice that it doesn't say there are no other gods. Isaiah is going to say that. But that's still a little ways away. He says, you shall have no other gods before me. Now, traditionally, we've interpreted that as sort of an issue of priority. Okay? So, what are the gods in your life? You know, or have you made this or that or the other thing your god that you've put ahead of God? So, we've typically said, no other gods before me, thinking of before as sort of prioritizations in your life. Philosophically, we've talked about monotheism. That is, that the Israelites were supposed to be monotheistic instead of polytheistic. But again, you'll notice it doesn't really say that. It says they shouldn't have other gods before him. Some see a shift in emphasis that is not so much philosophical monotheism, but it's monolatry. That is, you focus most of your worship on that one God. And so that you're not supposed to worship other gods instead of me, but in the ancient Near East context, what this statement does is it rules out a pantheon, divine assembly, and a consort. What's happening here? What's happening in the words? It's supported by the Hebrew preposition that we translate before. That preposition is usually spatial when combined with a personal object. That might sound a little confusing. What I mean by that is that if you say that all Jacob's sons should appear before him, that's not in time or priority, that's in space. Come into my presence. Okay, now there the object, that's Jacob, the personal object, if you've got a person. Okay, just like in this commandment, you shall have no other gods before me, the person is God. That should be spatial, not priority, okay, and not in a time sense. So what does that mean? God's saying, I work alone. You shouldn't imagine that there are other gods in my presence and that we do this community, council, decision-making thing. It doesn't work that way. Now again, let me explain how it is in the ancient world. In the ancient world, they had a pantheon, which was a heavenly court. Okay? The heavenly court made all the decisions. Now there was a head god in that heavenly court, but that wasn't a god that was higher ranked than the others, or more important than the others, or more powerful than the others. He was an administrator. He kind of ran the council meetings. Maybe he had seniority. In some cases, that's true. Okay, but the thing is, divine authority was existing in each of those gods around the table. Okay, divine authority was distributed. Each god had his slice of divine authority. And the other god couldn't intrude on that. What God's saying to the Israelites in the first commandment is, divine authority is not distributed among lots of different gods. Whatever power is exercised, whatever divine authority is exercised, comes from me. Don't imagine other gods get that distributed authority. I may choose to delegate roles to angels or to people, but that's delegation, that's not distribution. So what we've got is a picture of how the heavens work. He works alone. It does not say explicitly that no other gods exist. It does remove them from the presence of Yahweh. There are no other gods before me. If Yahweh does not share power, authority, or jurisdiction with others, they are not gods. Whatever they might be, they're not gods in any meaningful sense of the word. The first commandment then does not insist that the other gods are non-existent, but that they are powerless. It disenfranchises them. It does not simply say they shouldn't be worshipped. It leaves them with no status worthy of worship. There is nothing that commands your worship in this cosmos, Yahweh says, except me. Now, those of you who were here 2 weeks ago, and I talked about what existence means in the ancient world. Remember, I talked about the idea that it wasn't anything like physical, material existence, but it was the existence of functioning in a system. Something does not exist until it is functioning in an ordered system. That's how they thought in the ancient world. Compare this to that idea. If these gods, are not functioning with divine authority in the world, that would mean they do not exist. So, in that sense, Commandment 1 does say that the other gods do not exist, but it says it in the framework of how people thought in the ancient world. They have no divine authority, no divine functions. They are not worthy of worship. That's a whole lot different than how we typically think about the first commandment. Now, before we go into commandment 2, what does that mean for us? How do we think about that commandment? You can see why I'm not going to get past commandment 4. See, when we think about that commandment, instead of saying, what have you made a god in your life, which is kind of what we often do, we rather should be saying, don't think that you control your own life, that is, that you have arrogated to yourself divine authority, which is what we tend to do in our world. See, we're not inclined to delegate authority to other gods. We're inclined to take it for ourselves and think that we are the commander of our fate. That's a violation of the first commandment. It seems to think that there is other divine authority in the world besides Yahweh. Commandment 2. I'll try to move a little faster. Commandment 2. So you're not supposed to make any idols or images. Well, traditionally, people have seen some artistic limitations. We know this in Jewish history. They wouldn't, in any artwork of any sort, they wouldn't show, try to show what God looked like or what people, various animals, because those were limitations. They didn't want to violate the second commandment. It shows up even in, if you look at the history of icons in the Greek Orthodox Church. There are only a couple very brief periods in the history of art of the icons where they would actually show like God the Father or God the Spirit. Of course, they would show Christ. So artistic limitations, not making an image of deity. I remember growing up that for a while there was an argument going on in the States about whether it was inappropriate to have a picture of Jesus over the bed or in the house or something, that might be a violation of the second commandment. You see, people are confused about what the second commandment is all about. Theologically, they'll talk about transcendence. You know, God transcends any image, and so images are inappropriate because they somehow are a violation of understanding the transcendence of the all-powerful God. The ancient Near East, if we're going to understand the prohibition against images, we better understand images. What are images used for in the ancient Near East, and how do they work? What we find is that when they manufactured an image, the best craftsmen worked on it using the very best tools and the best materials, and they're crafting an image. And when they finish, they go through a very important ritual in which they take models of their tools and throw them in the river and ritually proclaim, we did not make this image. It is not of human design or manufacture. We had nothing to do with it. This image was born in heaven and created here on earth. It's a work of God. And so they would disavow any involvement in the process. And then as they used the image, this was an image that the deity had ordained and the deity had decided to use as a means of manifestation of his presence. And so the perception concerning the image was that the essence of the deity is in that image. If it's only a work of art, it's no good at all, and it's no problem. But they believed that the essence of the deity inhabited that image, and therefore the image could receive the worship. And remember, worship in this great symbiosis was the food offerings and all of those things. The praises and all of that could be given to the image because the image contained the essence of the deity. There's where the problem is. The image had a mediatorial role. How did that work? It mediates the presence of the deity because the essence of the deity is in it. So the God is there in the image. So it mediated presence. It mediated revelation. Remember I told you the gods in the ancient world did not reveal themselves. The only very slight exception to that is in the process of divination. In divination, the priest would bring an animal to be slaughtered, prepare a feast for the deity, and then would ask a question. Since they had now done this wonderful thing by giving food to the deity, they would ask a question. Should the king go to battle? Something very specific. And they believed that by examining the entrails of the sacrificed animal, they could do this liver divination and figure out what the god's answer was. That's all you get in terms of revelation. But it was the image that mediated those little bits of revelation. Also, of course, the image mediated worship. Worship was given to the god in the image, and then the god received it in that way. Images in the ancient world are mediators. They mediate those three things. That's the importance of the images. That's why God says you shouldn't make any images because I am not mediated in that way. God's only images are us. And of course, even more so, Christ, the true image. So our application to this would not be along the line of what are the idols in your life, or something of that sort. But rather, God has no needs. People are his only images. His presence is in us as believers, and Jesus is the only mediator. It's a lot different from the artistic kind of bent that sometimes we have. Now again, you can see that we don't have a lot of chance of understanding that commandment if we don't understand images in the ancient world. Now, this was revolutionary in the ancient world because who would have ever thought to come to the gods except through their images? The images are the core of this system. It's how the needs were met. It's how the worship was done. It's how the rituals were performed. Everything centered on those images. And for Deuteronomy to come along and say, nope, no images, it's, well, then what? What do we do? I mean, that pulls everything out. To say somehow we're supposed to worship differently. Well, what's that going to look like? How's that work? They couldn't even fathom how a system could work without images. And that all had to be developed. Commandment 3. Commandment 3 says, you should not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. For the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Okay, so what's up with that one? What's going on here? Well, traditionally, we think in terms of false oaths. You know, if you swear on the Bible, don't swear the wrong thing, you know, and not do it. If you take an oath falsely to a friend or, and again, an official capacity. So sometimes false oaths have been viewed, but actually false oaths comes up later on in the Ten Commandments. Not to bear false witness, for instance. Popularly, it's often in terms of blasphemy or profanity. You know, wash your mouth out, you know, these kinds of ideas that don't use Jesus' name, you know, lightly in your speech. And, you know, people will even get upset with using OMG in an email or things like that. You know, about how you use God's name in your common speech. Now, I don't want to say that the, unlike the other two, I don't want to say that these are not included, but they're pretty minor. They're pretty minor on the scope of what this commandment is shooting for. The shift with the ancient Near East is the understanding of magic. Now, I'm not talking Harry Potter here. Magic was a serious thing in the ancient world, and by the way, it's something that's largely indifferentiable from religion. Because religion was a way to try to understand the gods, but the end result of lots of that was to try to somehow gain some power over your life and your circumstances. And therefore, religion had a lot in it that was an attempt to exercise power. Again, I hope you keep listening for those echoes that may be appropriate to think about Christianity today as well. And I don't mean the magazine. Anyway, that just came. Okay. So, magic. Now, what happened with magic in the ancient world? Okay, I talked about divination. Divination was an attempt to gain knowledge by getting little bits of revelation extracted from the gods through these processes. So divination was an attempt to get knowledge. But then they wanted to go the next step and use that knowledge to exercise power. And that was done through a system of incantations that existed in the ancient world. Incantations were words of power being used to effect results. One of the most important elements used in incantations and the use of power was the name. The name of a person could be used to bind them or work against them, and the name of God could be used as an exercise of power against other people, or, should you dare, even against the God himself. Tricky stuff. You mess it up, you're in trouble. So we have the horizontal level, spells and exorcisms that existed in the ancient world. And this was commonplace in the ancient world. We've got the vertical level, to bind or to summon deity. So the name played a very significant role, and many of the gods in the ancient world hid their true names so that those names could not be used against them. Now, you wouldn't do that unless you considered it a real possibility, and they did. So the name could be used against them. Now, is there power in a name? By our hymns, you would guess that there is. There's power in the name of Jesus. In fact, you don't have to look much further than the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, what's the next line? Hallowed be your name. Starts with the name, because that name must be treated in a sacred, hallowed way rather than in a common, abusive way. Can we abuse the name of Jesus? Absolutely. And the Lord's Prayer continues, hallowed be your name, your kingdom come, not mine. Your will be done, not mine, on earth as it is in heaven. How does one accomplish one's own will instead of God's will? How does one present one's own will instead of God's? By using his name for your own things. Do we use the name of God for our own agendas? Absolutely. I'm not going to even guess at what percentage of our prayers in Jesus' name have more to do with us and our kingdom and our will instead of God's kingdom and God's will. But take a look at it. I'm not even going to talk about how many of our agendas in society and politics we recruit God's name to our side, whichever side that happens to be, so that God becomes the God of my cause. And we use God's name to bring credence and credibility to what are really just our own ideas. And we preach from our pulpits in the name of Jesus, and what we're preaching is really just our own ideas and our own agendas. Can we misuse the name of Jesus? Absolutely. The power, of course, is not in the name per se, but in the power of the bearer of the name. The more powerful the person, the more powerful the name. Name is related to identity. Now, some people have objected. They say, you know, you're making an awful big deal about this. After all, a name is just what? Sounds. Sounds. And some people might call God by one name and another name, and it doesn't really make a big difference, does it? I mean, it's just syllables that you pronounce or squiggles you write on a page. What kind of power is that in that? Those are random things that have no intrinsic meaning. If you really believe that, feel free to, I'll pass around a list and you can write down your credit card numbers for me to take with me. I mean, after all, it's just a random collection of numbers, right? It doesn't mean anything. I mean, it's just random numbers. Oh, wait. Those numbers have power, don't they? And they have power because they're connected to your identity. And we call it identity theft when somebody gets your identification numbers of one sort or another, because they can use it against you for their own agendas, their own purposes, their own means. And so we protect that identity. And ATMs don't have a big broadcasting screen when you type in your PIN numbers and things, right? We protect those things because they have power. Now, the power of those numbers is very much related to, in this case, your own economic power. That is, if you only have $4.25 in your bank account, no big deal if somebody gets a hold of your bank account number. But the more you've got in there, the more powerful those numbers are. We understand this, we really do. We understand the power connected to identity, and that name is connected to identity. So identity theft is what's going on in the third commandment. When God says you should not use my name in vain, he's talking about identity theft, where we take his name and use it to do our own stuff. Now, this was revolutionary in the ancient world because there, again, God's name was used regularly. That's how the system worked. But here God's saying, no, it's not going to work this way here. The name was not to be used as an efficacious symbol to achieve one's own self-interests. That's kind of a complicated paraphrase of the third commandment, but that gets the basic idea across. The name of God was not to be used as an efficacious symbol to achieve one's own self-interests. And again, Jesus simply repeats that in the Lord's Prayer. But we didn't know he was doing it because we thought it was just about typing OMG. There's a whole lot more to it going on. Commandment 4. Now, you already have a good idea of what I do with Commandment 4 because we talked about Sabbath and things of that sort. So let's run through this briefly, and then I'll conclude this. I want to leave a little time for questions, so we need to get to that soon. Traditionally, it was, Now, see, I would change that now. Traditionally, it's imitating the divine. Okay? or commemorating, that God rested and so we should rest, caring for others, okay, these kinds of things. In this case, it's interesting because there is no ancient Near Eastern observance of the Sabbath. This is uniquely Israelite. We could say that maybe someday we'll find something in the ancient world, but by now, with a million tablets, if it were there, we'd see some hint of it, and we don't. So this is a unique observance for Israel. Comparative help comes then from understanding divine rest, and that's what I talked about 2 weeks ago as we talked about what's involved with divine rest. In the Old Testament, the people work for their own benefit and provision rather than to meet the needs of God or to do his work for him. That's the great symbiosis issue. They are commanded to share the rest of God on the Sabbath, not to imitate it per se, but in order to recognize his work of bringing and maintaining order. In fact, I would say that it's participating at a different sort of level, not imitating it. God's resting, so I'm resting. Okay, that's good. But rather participating in it because God's work is kingdom work. He has brought order so that he can run his kingdom. And when we rest, we participate in that order. Okay, not participate in relaxation. That's the difference between them. His control is represented in his rest and is recognized by yielding for the day their own attempts to provide for themselves. So it's a little bit different view towards Sabbath. Remember that in Deuteronomy, the Sabbath legislation does not have to do with creation. It has to do with the fact that he freed them from slavery. And again, that means that he gave them freedom from their overlords so that they would have some control of their own lives and environment, but they're supposed to recognize that he is the one who is truly in charge. Okay, let's end with this slide and then I'll open it for some questions. These four commandments then, let's set them up. Commandment one concerned how Yahweh was not to be perceived as operating in the divine realm. That is, don't have other gods before me. This is not how I act. This is not how I work. There's no distribution of authority to other divinities. It's how God operates in the divine realm. Commandment two is how Yahweh was not to be perceived as operating in the human realm. Okay, so when you are coming to me, you don't come through idols and their mediation. No iconography, no mediator of his presence, revelation, or worship offered to him. So I don't work with a committee in heaven, and I don't work through an idol on earth. I work alone, and my mediators are people. Okay, so how God should not be understood as working in the heavens and how he should not be understood as working on earth. Commandment three concerned how Yahweh's power and authority was not. Remember, these are negatives. Don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, right? They're negatives. So concerned how Yahweh's power and authority was not to be perceived. That is, people were to recognize it by refraining from attempts to control it. You don't try to control God through the use of his name. You don't try to channel God's power through you. You don't try to take God's authority for what it is that you are doing and saying. If a teacher of the Bible or a preacher of the Bible stands up and gives their own agenda and sets it up as if this is the word of the Lord, that's very potentially a violation of Commandment 3. Because they are using God's name to give credibility to their own ideas. That's Commandment 3. And then related, Commandment 4 is concerned how Yahweh's power authority was to be perceived. Here we've got the negative in 3 and the positive in 4. In 3, we don't think of it as something we can use for our own agendas. In 4, we're concerned how Yahweh's power and authority was to be perceived. Remember, Commandment 4 is positive. Okay, honoring the Sabbath, that's a positive. The first 3 were negatives. People were to recognize it by refraining from attempts to control their own lives on the Sabbath. You can see that both 3 and 4 have to do with issues of power, authority, and control. So 1 and 2 are juxtaposed, and 3 and 4 are juxtaposed. Well, those are the first 4 commandments. There are six others, but we're not going to get to those tonight. Time for Q&A.